The following broadcast was produced by the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco as part of our Lighthouse Learning Library.
So earlier today, I had extensive conversations with Bill that I want to get back to. But since you're in here for a while, Brian, let's use you as a subject briefly, and then you can help me interview Bill since you know him somewhat better than I. How long have you been blind, Brian?
I've been blind for, maybe 32 years now, since I was a sophomore in college.
And how did you lose your vision?
It was a process that was slow, result of an autoimmune thing that happened. But I crossed over into legal blindness somewhere in my sophomore year.
And do you have any vision now?
Just light perception.
Where'd you go to school?
I grew up in Los Angeles area. Went to school down at Birmingham High School in Encino first, and then up in UC Berkeley, where I got degrees and started working in San Francisco after that in 1980 or so.
I see. And where did you learn the skills of blindness?
You know, like many people, I stayed away from acquiring the skills as long as I could fake it and get by on what was a little bit of vision. But the NFB did have a training center in Sacramento for 1 year in 1994. And when I learned about it, I was one of the students there. The NFB training center there was much like the centers NFB still runs in Minnesota and Colorado and Louisiana. And many of the same folks worked there, and the principals were the same. So I threw myself into it, and that's where I learned my blindness skills.
How old were you at that time?
39.
So you'd spent about 20 years of adulthood without those skills. Are you an adept Braille reader now?
I am. I read Braille. It was only at the NFB Training Center that for the first time I picked up a white cane and have been using it continuously since. Computer skills, Braille skills, and all those other intangible skills that make the difference between just getting by and a life with self-confidence and self-respect.
What were you doing in your life before you took the time to go to the NFB Training Center in Sacramento?
Both before and after that training, I was working as a science journalist, and I had a science news syndicate called the Center for Science Reporting. And I wrote about science and public policy for newspapers and magazines. And I did that before, although it got increasingly difficult as I lost more vision. After the training, I went back and had the most successful years as a journalist I ever had, because I was using the alternative techniques that I learned. And in and around that time, we founded the Sacramento NFB chapter. And one of the earliest guests to come to talk about some of his experiments and some of his experiences over the decades was Bill Gary, who came out to Sacramento. And Bill, I think I may have that tape of your presentation from 1995 or 1996.
Well, that'd be fun to hear that.
So how did you get in the business of administering organizations like the San Francisco Lighthouse?
That's an interesting story. I didn't have a background in nonprofit administration. I went to school with journalism. I worked in journalism and radio and television and print and magazines, and I was happily doing that. And 4 years after I got my training at the NFB Center, a friend said, the director at the Society for the Blind in Sacramento is retiring after 33 years, and you should apply. And I told my friend that I didn't know anything about nonprofit administration. They weren't persuaded. They said, you have to ask some fresh things. The society could benefit from your asking these fresh questions. Apply. And so I did. And they had very many applicants. And perhaps it was because of my relative indifference about whether I was accepted or not that made me the candidate that they selected.
Were you the first blind person in that position?
I was the first blind director there of that agency, and still retain that title. There have been two directors after me, the only blind director at that agency.
And here at the Lighthouse of San Francisco, you're the first blind director?
No, the Lighthouse is 102 years old, and my predecessor, Anita Aaron, who was director for 19 years, is blind.
Uh-huh.
So I learned about nonprofit administration there at Society for the Blind, and I was there for half a dozen years. And then when you get the opportunity to work for Joanne Wilson in any way, shape, or form, when she was commissioner of the RSA, there was the regional office position in San Francisco that was open, and I applied for that position. And from 2004 until the end of all the regional offices of RSA, I worked in that capacity and learned the federal rehabilitation process, and did that and a few other things along the way until 6 months ago I started working here as director at the San Francisco Lighthouse.
Were you involved with the NFB before you went to this training center in 1994?
I was. I had gone to some meetings, and actually for me, what was key was to find blind role models. As my vision diminished, I knew there were blind inventors, scientists, writers, administrators throughout the gamut, but I didn't know any of them. And reading the Braille Monitor in the early 90s, I started making notes of people who were doing cool things. And I actually looked them up and found some in Northern California. And those were some of my early mentors into blindness. And it was through their information that I learned that NFB was setting up the new training center in Sacramento. And those human-to-human contacts were all essential.
And what became of the Sacramento Training Center?
Well, for complicated reasons, it had to close at the end of 1994. There were economic and other issues involved, and so it did close. The model that it was working on was not at that time sustainable out here, I think.
My understanding is that the Louisiana Center, which is the one I have most familiarity with, I was there for a week shortly after I started at the NFB, that the Louisiana Center gets money from the state of Louisiana, and when they take students from elsewhere, the state governments cover them. Was that not going to happen in California?
We did get Department of Rehab money in the NFB training centers, but it was the first year of the center. It was not enough and not fast enough. And California has four other blindness residential training centers. And it takes a while. It takes a bridge of time to get established and running in a way that is a viable option for clients in California. And I just don't think there was enough time to set those referral patterns up before it had to close.
Well, that's regrettable, I'm sure. Did you ever feel a conflict as a loyal member of the Federation and an employee of an agency between the way the agency might want to do things and the way the NFB does?
There is a tension there, and I think there are some principles one has to follow. As any community agency has to be open to every stripe of the community because it's about services and training, so it is not, no agency that I've yet worked for has been an official NFB training center, so we have to make people welcome of all stripes. On the other hand, I think agencies are stronger when they are closest to their community. And the closer that we had relations with all the articulate and passionate people in our community, the more honest and the more effective I think all agencies can be. And that's the model I used in Sacramento, and that's the model we're using here at the Lighthouse now.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. So you have no problem with the NFB and the openness that you have. I want to talk frankly about these things because I personally want to learn more about the NFB and its relations with its most articulate members and their feelings about the organization and the alternatives.
Sure. which direction do you want to pursue here?
Well, talk about your life in the as an NFB mm-hmm, member.
Mm-hmm. I've been active in my affiliate ever since I first learned about the NFB, and I've served in all kinds of capacities as the need arisen, and I've been asked. I've served in our scholarship committee and in research and development committee I serve on now, and in our Quiet Cars committee and other things. I've served in our state affiliate, founding a chapter in Sacramento, and on our board of directors for many years. Although I don't hold any official position with the NFB now, I'm certainly a contributing member. And I make no bones about where I learned about my blindness and blindness philosophy, and that philosophy of positivism and self-respect comes directly from the NFB. I cannot myself insist that any individual who comes to any group that I work with must follow one pattern or another, but I'm free and open about the things that got me to be the self-respecting blind person I am. And that was important, as important for me in blindness as learning to read is in literacy for me. One, it gave me a vocabulary, and it gave me a context in which I want to develop blind positive programming and serve the community in intense and immersive ways.
Mm-hmm. I was telling Bill earlier that I became friendly with Dan Fry, who just stepped down after a very short spell as editor of the Braille Monitor. And Dan was telling me about a member of his age cohort named Zachary Shore, who's a pretty distinguished historian now. And Dan regretted the fact that Zach Shore, although remaining a member of the NFB, really has stepped back from it. And Dan's thought was that someone like Zachary Shore, a very accomplished, very intelligent person, needs to be actively involved in the NFB for the benefit of those who are less capable than he. And Dan assured me when he left the employ of the NFB that he'd continue being an active, participating member. And it sounds like that's kind of the approach that you have, Brian.
I'll make a contribution wherever I'm asked, and I have and will. Zach Shore is a good friend of mine, mm-hmm. and he teaches at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey. He's written 7 books now to wide appeal, and he has an active correspondence with Dr. Maurer, and also he has cast some things in print about his experience with Dr. Jernigan, who was his first link to the NFB. And I encourage you to find a way to talk to Zach Shore and hear his story directly from him.
Okay, well, I certainly don't want you to speak for Zach Shore. I wanted to see if there, you know, a commonality and or where there's a divergence in how important it is, how important a blind person who's so to speak made it, who is self-respecting and independent, and how important your continued involvement with the NFB is. What Dan had said to me is that because of the NFB that he's the self-confident, independent person he is, and he owes it to his blind brothers and sisters to be actively involved in their behalf. And it sounds like you feel that way, and that the NFB is the vehicle in which to do that.
It is. It is at a very particular time in my life. It was the reason why I found a new paradigm about how to be blind in an effective and joyous way. And I don't know what I would have done if I had to depend upon Hollywood or just being a lone wolf in the wilderness to get me there. I think everybody learns from models of success. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why I invited Bill Gary to come to a newly formed chapter, because he is a model of how to work with things. How does a blind person learn to solder? It's not about the soldering. It's about learning that you're an active person in the world, that you can think up things and try them out and fail and try something new. And that paradigm is something that I think a lot of blind kids don't grow up with it, carrying around it in their heads about it. So, yes, it is in terms of setting the, not just the intellectual, but the emotional context of what it is to be blind and effective and also cool. This is where the NFB often makes a really huge contribution. We talk so much about civil rights and other things, but I think part of the real contribution the NFB makes is just for having a platform for where cool people are.
Yeah. Do you know Maurice Perret?
I do.
Maurice insists that he's one cool dude. He's a funny guy. Let me ask you about your experiences with the leadership of the NFB. You've mentioned Joanne Wilson, who I'm privileged to work with in Baltimore, who I just think is an astounding person. The energy that she put into getting the first NFB organized training center set up, her unhappy experiences as a federal bureaucrat, I just find her a particularly friendly, open, and energetic person. How about other people in the leadership of the organization? Did you know Kenneth Jernigan at all well?
I did, and it was a pivotal experience for me. I mean, I met Dr. Jernigan early in my journey, and he invited me to Baltimore on several occasions as his guest to talk about what we could do in journalism to get the NFB story out in different ways, and about the science and technology aspect of what we wish as blind people. He was so generous. He had me up to his home. He cooked for me, sometimes making meals out of scraps, and just, it wasn't about the dinner. It was about something a little bit beyond that. And I remember one particular night at the national headquarters where I think he and I were the only ones in the building that night. And he sat up in that harbor room and with cups and saucers and knives and forks, drew a diagram of the trade routes in the Mediterranean in the 14th century and showed the importance of Italy in this and talked about the Renaissance and talked about the changing world powers. And we didn't go to bed till 3 a.m. And to see a guy with that breadth of experience and passion and the ability to connect with people made a lifelong impression on me.
That's fascinating. I hear that type of thing about Kenneth Jernigan. People who knew him well seem really devoted to him. Mark Maurer, have you had much interaction with Mark Maurer?
I have, from the very beginning. When I first got involved with the training center in Sacramento and afterwards, he was almost always at Dr. Jernigan's side in those years in the mid-90s. And I met him, and he also had me to his home. And I was impressed by a number of things. Certainly, he's a leader in the NFB and has very forceful and complicated aspects to him. But I loved it when I was at his home and there was a problem with his refrigerator. We got down on the floor and we had to improvise a kind of lever to raise the refrigerator up so we could shim it and make it level and work better. And I think there was just something about, as a person who was newly out about blindness and using non-visual techniques, to be on the floor on all fours with Dr. Maurer and to just say, we have a problem, let's just fix it, let's just figure out a way. I'm not going to, there's no specialness about blindness, there was no high technology or any preciousness about it. We were just solving a problem together, and that's kind of a metaphor for how I saw him going forward.
This is fascinating because as a sighted person, relatively new to the world of blindness, I find blind guys frequently as role models for me about see a problem, you deal with it.
You deal with it.
And you don't have to be, you don't have to be blind to look at things that way. You don't have to be blind to fail to be able to look at things that way. And sometimes I see in the NFB and the notion that you take care of things. There's a woman working at the National Center named Treva Olivero. Treva has had a leg amputated. She's got no residual vision to speak of. She may have some light sensitivity, and she insists on using a non-powered wheelchair, and gets around with her right hand pushing, right arm pushing the wheel, and the left arm with the cane, and she had to go to an event by herself as part of her job responsibilities that was in Texas. And she got to the, her husband was telling me this afterwards, she got there and found that they did not have an accessible room for wheelchair people. I said to her husband, well, what did she do? And he said, she took a non-accessible room and she did it. Yeah. You know, and that general approach to things that I just find at my advanced age kind of useful. I was telling you that I don't like to travel, and I see, you know, blind guys getting on planes going all over the place and figuring out how to get to where they want to go to. My guess is that was much more the exception before the days of Newell Perry and Jacobus Ten Broeck.
Well, we'll hear about that. But Bill, do you still walk to work?
I've got a foot problem that precludes that at this time, but I will do again. It's 26 blocks the way I do it. But it's, you know, San Francisco's a provincial little place. Has a lot of normal width streets, and it's not quite like the peninsula further south where there are six-lane things everywhere, but it lends itself to sort of my Nevada boy country style of living, and I go where I want to go.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you want to add anything, Brian? I'm sure that there's a lot more to Brian Bashan and his blindness that's not evident to me right away because we didn't have a chance to talk before this. What further would you like to say?
I just want to say I welcome the chance to get to know you more and follow any contribution you wish me to make, but I am passionate about our history. And one of the photographs I have is the California Institution for the, it's a postcard, the California Institution for the Deaf and Blind in, I think, 1906 is the picture. It was a lone Victorian building in the Bear Hills in the East Bay. And I think about that often as I think about those early times and the world that Newell Perry started with and how we are all heirs to the organizations and the brain trust that he created. So as we go forward, if you wish me to connect you with some of the people who are still around, and there are a few critical people we really want to interview, I'm very happy to do it.
Oh, that would be great. That's terrific. Okay. Let's turn to...
Very good, Brian.
Let's turn to Bill.
Thank you for the accolades.
Well, you are an interesting guy, Bill, so I guess worthy of accolades. Let's start, Bill, with your own background, and then we'll go into your genealogy, so to speak. You were born in Nevada.
In Reno.
That
was a gamble. They lost.
Ba-dum-bum. And you were telling me earlier, well, why don't you review?
I'm second generation. My father and I both had bilateral retinoblastoma. He had his eyes enucleated in after 6 months. And I at 10 months. And he, because of just hearing about a school at year, when he was 8 years old, came to the California State School for the Blind in on Derby Street in Berkeley, and got his education there. I, on the other hand, spent much of my boyhood after his retirement here in California, where we came to California in 1954. And so by the time I came here, I was 6 years old, and I went through 1 year of public school at, or 1 year of blind school at the California School for the Blind. And then the mainstreaming programs became prolific. And sure enough, in my hometown, we had one of those programs, almost experimental at the time, run by one woman in a what we often called the Braille room in various of these schools, in an elementary school. And so from second grade on, I was a product of the public school system, after which, after high school, I went to 1 year of junior college at Chabot College in Hayward, and then to Cal Poly, where I spent 4 years getting a Bachelor of Science degree in electronics engineering, as they called it then. That's since the title has been abolished, and when I write it down, it's electrical engineering.
You mentioned when we spoke on the phone that you, with a hereditary problem, happened to come on the scene just when all of these premature babies were coming on with retinopathy of prematurity, and that the number of blind kids really kind of overwhelmed the schools for the blind.
It tripled the population of that little blind school. Was designed for 50 kids, and there were 150 when I went there.
And is that part of the reason that you didn't like it, or that it was too crowded?
No, I just didn't do well at a place with, you know, for all the development of that. Many of the people who were hired at those places were not the polished, credentialed educators of today, and so there was always the inconsistency of authority here and there, or things that just I considered, well, I only know now that I consider, I cracked under just the what seemed to be an unbeatable arbitrariness of the situation. My father did fine. He didn't understand why I was so unhappy.
Hmm.
But boy, oh boy, there was a family doctor who discovered the trend of these mainstream programs, and he said, one's starting up right in your town here, Castro Valley, California. And boy, was I set free. Huh. I felt a great relief.
Did you learn Braille at the blind school, though?
Yes.
You did.
And I understand that I would have gotten a fine education, an academic education there.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, I visited there at the fifth grade and met many of the kids that I had been in the dormitory with, in the annex dormitory, which harbored fit nine kids in this room with beds cheek by jowl. And I went through their day of classes, and they were hard.
Uh-huh.
They were hard for me. I remember a typing class where we were handed a Braille sheet, just a copy exercise. And I had taken typing too for at least a year that I thought I was okay at. And when they said go, I never heard people type that fast. So they were doing well academically.
And at that time, the School for the Blind was still largely children with blindness only and no other handicaps. Because my
That's correct.
Okay. Right. So you were one of the first to be mainstreamed, and over time, most blind kids with just one disability came to be mainstreamed.
Well, it's not quite that simple. And I wasn't the first, by the way. There were other kids who left about the same time I did as they set these programs up. No, the residential schools are still... used where somebody just cannot get service. There are itinerant teachers who have a van full of appropriate equipment and so forth who drive around, and you might see your special category teacher twice a week if you're lucky. And there are places where they don't go, and the school has them as part of their population, and they can be as bright as Brian here. There is a dual population there, and there are just so many reasons to be disabled, especially with prematurity. You get combinations, what we now call coexisting disabilities, and so forth. So residential school serves some of those children too. So it's complicated a little bit because you still have the smart, walking around, running around kid who needs support to be able to do that too.
Bill, I wanted to get to something you mentioned at the outset before we get further into your life. Your dad was blind. Did you say he was 8 when he came to the California school?
That's correct.
What year would that have been about?
1919. No, that wouldn't be right either. He was born in essentially 1910. So he would have come in there in 1918. He remembered the war and that the all the war songs and the so forth and all that kind of stuff, and that people's families were gravely affected by World War I.
What stories did he bring down to you about what the blind school was like in the 1918 and the early 20s?
Yes, I could go on ad infinitum when you talk about Newell Perry had set up the department, what became the Department of Advanced Studies, but he had taken a look at each and every student and pulled out any of them that had a bit of a spark and put them through special paces. There was a study time, 2 hours a night, 5 days a week. And Dr. Perry had worked out a way for college students from the University of California to get some credit somehow or something in order to entice them to come and be readers for the kids and to help them with work and so forth. And then he also set up with a college prep school at that time called University High, which was set up to take sighted kids through the brightest of them through the paces to feed them into Cal Berkeley. And so he set up a situation where his blind kids would go for the last 2 years of their four-year high school education at University High. And so in a way, he was on a fast track for something. They recognized that he had essentially a rich background from his family. He ended up skipping three grades on the way through to high school. And the stories were things like when readers were reading to the students from some of these, as I say, from Cal, Dr. Perry would reach around behind this child or that just randomly and take the short hairs of the back of his head and jerk them up and down and say, "What'd she say? What'd she say?" And stuff like that. So he was quite a taskmaster, and he taught them all of the Bright group, taught them all grade three Braille. They came out, he hoped, especially out of University High, to be Cal students. And that led to the brain trust, as we, as I call it, of the blind folks who formed the California Council of the Blind, I think in 1934, and which became national by Tenbrook's efforts in 1940. Oh, that diverted from your question tremendously.
No, it's a start, but there's this chapter in the late teens and early 20s is something that's not represented well in our literature.
Uh-huh.
If you know, this month is now, it's been co-opted. You know, California Disability History. People think that disability history started in the 70s or 80s or whatever. Uh-huh. And this business of Dr. Perry and this rigorous, relentless devotion to achievement is relatively unknown in the wider disability community. I wonder what made, from what you remember from your father, what made Dr. Perry tick? What made him so driven to build this brain trust? And
part of it may have been his drive to be taken extra seriously. He, apparently, one of the stories is that he stowed away on a vessel to Europe and then got his doctorate in mathematics in Heidelberg.
Yes.
And he came back to the United States and couldn't find work, and was eventually hired at the School for the Blind as a teacher. And now, he was so proud of his being Dr. Perry that even though the superintendent at the time, fellow with the last name of French, was also a doctorate of educational type, I suppose, Dr. French, whom Dr. Perry insisted on calling Mr. French. and he insisted on being called Doctor. Apparently his wife had to call him Doctor. And that was a beginning of something that, although there was an endearing, an endearing story of where a new kid came to the school, and I heard this from Vern Nelson, another student, and the kid was Perry Sundquist, and Dr. Perry somehow encountered him, and he says, "Well, what is your name, young man?" "Perry." "Can you prove it?" And Perry just sort of stuttered around, and he says, "Well, that's all right. My name's Perry, too." He had kindness, but he was obsessed with achievement, that's for sure.
And you knew him yourself, and yes, as when he was quite old.
Yeah.
He never lost his mental acuity, did he?
Not in my knowing him, and I can't remember when he died, but when in 1956, I was 9 years old, and I was at the convention, in San Francisco at the Elks Club, and he showed me several things that impressed him at the AIDS and Appliances table, which AFP had set up there. And just to sort of size me up, he picked me up. He was a short man, so it didn't take much picking before I was even with his head. And he was, at least by that time, he was short. But I remember visiting him three or four times in my memory at his home. And it was a nice home, and people would just drop in. I mean, he had a real loyal bunch. And then there's the story, which may take too long.
I don't think so. Go ahead.
Well, my father didn't know that he was going to pass on a gene that would result in a blind child. So, and my father had skipped the state of California in order to avoid being funneled into the California, the Cal, to be funneled into Cal after university high school. He graduated from Uni High, but then he took off. And he was already registered by work of Dr. Perry and his minions to enter Cal, but he didn't want anything to do with it. So he went back to Reno, where another student of CSB was trained by a man of the Chickering Piano Factory, who trained my father, another blind guy training another blind guy. And my folks had a very successful piano business coexisting with the man who trained him. And also, by the way, there was piano tuning as a shop course in the school, and my father had taken that. So anyway, here we were in Reno, successful. My sister, who is sighted, was born in 1942. I was born in 1947. And by 1948, they knew they had a blind child. So they called Dr. Perry and asked him what to do about this, because the Nevada children were not going to the California school because of the glut of blind children. They were being absorbed in part by the Utah School for the Blind. Mm-hmm. And my folks assume that was a lesser education. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. I've known some very highly educated people came from Utah, but from that school. But be that as it may, Dr. Perry got on a train. You know, the rumor, of course, is always around that that this great man or that great person doesn't travel by himself. The rumors are usually not true. And in this case, Dr. Perry got on a train to Reno and to come and visit the boy. And at the age of 1.5, I'm told, or something, two years old maybe, it was a piano shop. There were pianos everywhere, in every room. And my mom said, go play the piano, dear. And I went and I picked out something on the black keys that my sister, who was studying piano, has played. And Dr. Perry, so they tell me, said, this boy needs a good education.
Now, when you affect Newell Perry's voice, is this from memory?
It's something like from memory.
Uh-huh.
I think I've got it pretty much right,
uh-huh,
with the rolling R's and things too. And so he said the only way that you can go to the California School for the Blind is to be resident in California. So you'll have to move. So do you know my mother said, fine, this is fine. I want to work out different investments. My father was getting quite ill from actually the nervous tension of piano tuning and so forth, which was, it was egregious work.
Mm-hmm.
And so they liquidated the piano business and came to California in order to put me in the California School for the Blind. Dr. Perry was no longer working there, but it was in his mind the way to get the best education. And the fact that I didn't psychologically survive well must have been a great disappointment to everybody.
Huh.
But be that as it may, that's the kind of power he had. Here's a boy who deserted him, and with one phone call, he showed up. And he had such power over them that they changed their entire livelihood to bend to his recommendation.
Huh. Tenbrook said that when he went when he started at Cal, that he couldn't get support. That the only support for the blind in California was for them to sit at home and not to not to get an advanced education. And that it was Perry's doing that he was able to do that. I've read somewhere that that was the basis for the creation of the American Brotherhood of the Blind. Do you know anything about that?
I don't. No, I don't. But it was certainly Chick Tenbrook's idea or speech in 1948 that there are recordings of, that where a relative's responsibility and all that crazy stuff was being overthrown as because of they depended on the state you were in, and states generally were competing to be the lowest provider they could possibly get away with,
mm-hmm.
and that was true with the creation of the Iowa Commission and all that stuff that really unified things under a federal system. But boy, I don't know how that worked, because there were a lot of students there. There were at least of the Cal students I knew of, you know, Perry Sundquist was one of them. Of course, there's Dr. Tenbrook, whose writing, by the way, was used in colleges as he was defendant of the students in a fracas called the Free Speech Movement that started with protests of the House Un-American Activities Committee. And so there were students very active in the left Cal Berkeley, and Dr. Tenbrook was in the Academic Senate, and his speeches were used as examples for public speaking, for arguing a point for their organization, and so forth. So I don't know how the other kids got through Cal, but I'm awfully glad it worked.
Yeah.
Did you ever get a feeling that your father going into a profession like piano tuning successfully was at a dissonance from Newell Perry's vision of what blind guys should be doing, or was that okay?
You know, it's interesting because Muzzy Marcellino, who was also a younger, but certainly a major figure in the California Council of the Blind, which used to be the NFB chapter in California. He told a story about somebody criticizing the idea that blind people were entering the field of chiropractics.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow apparently said, "You know that's quackery, don't you?" "Yes, but it is a good living." So I think that there's a wonderful paper written by Bertold Lowenfeld called Higher Education and its effect on employment of the blind, where he found as many of those students through the period that you were speaking of, back to World War I, as many of those students as he could, and he surveyed them to see how many of them were employed and what they were doing. And not all of them came out of Cal Berkeley with law degrees or sociology degrees. Not all of them. Mm-hmm.
The preceding material is owned and distributed by the Lighthouse for the Blind in San Francisco, California. To obtain permission to use this content for classes or other uses, please contact us at publications@lighthouse-sf.org. Or to learn more about the Lighthouse, visit our website at www.lighthouse-sf.org.